Hi, you guys. I apologize if my audio sucks. I saw Patrick speak today, and he had these really sweet headphones, and I bet that was better. But it's cool. This is all I've got. Hopefully, it's not terrible. Hello. Thank you. I'm Amber. Thank you, Patrick. Happy birthday to me. This is my fourth year in ACA this month. So this program is continuing to be part of my life, but I'm really happy to celebrate this milestone and this month in this time in this year and in my life feels very significant to me. So it feels, it's an honor to be here with you sharing my story. I'm going to share some pictures. This is me as a baby. See? Boop. Little baby. My trauma started at birth because I was born. I got kind of stuck for a few hours and my mom couldn't come out. I ended up almost dying and I got care flighted in the first ever helicopter ride from where I grew up. I grew up in the middle of the woods, like the middle of nowhere. It was beautiful. This is me at the mill pond by my house, swimming. But there's really nothing. So it's kind of a miracle that I lived because the helicopter that flew me over to Reno from where I was born, it was the first flight it had ever taken and they had just procured it. It arrived at the hospital like the week before. So it started out kind of rough. I spent the first week of my life in an incubator. My parents were super young. So they got together. I was just like combing through pictures real quick right before this. And I didn't find one of both of them, but this is my dad, like right before they got married. And he's young. He got married at 19. My mom and dad were 19 and 20, when they married, and they were 22 when they had me, or my dad was. And, I think they didn't have all the tools they needed, you know, as grown up adults to raise a family. I'm one of three, so I'm the oldest of three. The picture that I included in my like ACA journal is of my siblings, and I'm my little brother and sister, and this is me. This is the year. Like, I think about things in terms of milestone years, and this year I was nine, and this is the year that my parents really struggled, but I'm skipping ahead. But when I think about my family and my role in my family, I think of it that way, sort of with that picture in mind, that my role was really to take care of my brother and sister and to be the oldest sibling. And I kind of always had that sort of protective, like, stance about me, whether it was in my mind or not. My dad was the one that we'd always really identified as the problem. You know, it wasn't until ACA that I kind of learned to expand my thinking about my family. But my dad was the one who I identified as an alcoholic growing up. He was doing drywall and like kind of using the alcohol and the speed and the weed and whatever kind of get through this life. Like, I always was recognizing throughout his life that there was this sort of unfulfilled potential. Like, I think I became the product of my dad's unfulfilled potential. You know, that he had this relationship to his sense of self-worth that really had to do with feeling like he'd fallen short and he wasn't sure what he should do, but he knew it wasn't this, you know? So my dad was angry most of my life. And for a lot of my life, that I would say that's the only emotion that I saw him express, you know, that I knew he was capable of expressing was anger. Sometimes you could almost trick him into having fun, like remembering that he liked to dance or something, but I just mainly remember him being angry. When he'd get home from work, he'd be yelling and, you know, so many fuck, 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 like super mad. So we all grew to be careful around him to anticipate, you know, what might come. And I think it's my hypersensitivity started really early just in trying to manage, you know, his feelings and that if he was happy, we would all have a better life. And so I kind of became aware of which things he liked or didn't like, or, you know, I became aware at an early age that there was such a thing as something that someone says and then something that is actually true based on what you could observe. So they might say that they didn't like to be invited to do something, but then once they were invited, they liked it. And then once they showed up at the thing and they danced, they really liked it. So I started to disbelieve people, like in terms of what they said. Because with my dad, I always saw this evidence that I knew better than him, that like, he didn't know how to make himself happy, and that I could ultimately, like, I spent a lot of my life organizing myself around figuring out how to make him happy. And it really did develop in me this quality of managing other people's feelings, you know, and taking care of everybody else and making sure that everyone in the room had a great time. So nine years old, that was when the shit went down. Like, my dad had always gotten it. He'd have these habits. My mom, what's interesting about their background, when you think about, like, generationally, and when I think about, oops, I got muted somehow, but I just unmuted myself. Okay. Did you guys miss that? Okay. When I think about the tools of ACA, I think about, like, for me, I bring it up to a lot of people, but it was so wicked important for me to go through the step one, like, family tree. And look at all this. And early on in the program, I had a sponsor who was helping me kind of through that. It was really interesting to see sort of the generational nature of the dysfunction and how it passed down and how my lived experience growing up, the AC helped me, like, reinterpret it. So growing up, I believed that my dad was the problem, that he was the alcoholic, that my mom, you know, she was doing her best. I know now she was, you know, codependent. She was definitely going to Al-Anon sometimes. Like, we all went to meetings at a certain period in my life when I was 9 years old. But she's a product herself of a very dysfunctional family, where I think the main things that I experienced her taking out from that were black and white thinking, Catholicism. So I was brought up very strictly in Catholicism, with my mom taking us to church every weekend, not my dad. And he would kind of stay home and watch football. He grew up Episcopal, and religion was really important to his family too. But in our nuclear family, he stayed home and she took us to church. It was important to her that we went. So with the Catholic upbringing and my mom's way of thinking, I took a lot of, like, black and white thinking, right and wrong, the sense of being, you know, not okay in the world, that you have to prove yourself, that you have to become okay in the world, that you have to become a good person over time by proving yourself and confessing your sins and all the nature of that. So I did grow up a lot of that time wondering if I was bad, believing I was bad, not wanting to get in trouble. When I was 2 and a half, and then again when I was 6, I was molested by an older boy. So I personally was struggling with, like, some amounts of that, the things that happen to you as an individual that have you question your sense of autonomy and authority, you know, like, so very early on, I had somebody put in my head that, like, that this thing that I said I didn't want, this authority and autonomy over myself, that it wasn't my right to decide that, you know, somebody said, no, you do like that. Like, you liked it before when you were 2, so you definitely like it now when you're 6. And so I experienced that first time of consenting, I say quote unquote, because it, like, consenting under duress is not consenting, but, like, agreeing to let somebody do something to me that I didn't like. And that played out in my life, because these things we learn when we're young do that in pattern. When I was 9, my parents split up. There was, like, this big thing. I call it the night. It was, like, an event in my family that I remember, where my mom and dad had a huge fight, and it was really scary. It was really scary to be 9 and 6 and 3, the ages of the kids that we were. It was really violent. It was really angry. And the next day, I remember my dad was so angry that he had taken, we'd had a pony at our house at that point, and he had taken the bales of hay from the pony, and the next day we would have gone to church typically, and he had shoved the bales of hay into the car, like, so we couldn't do anything. So literally, like, one bale of hay in each section of this little tiny wagon we had. And I remember just believing in my mind, like, how fucking scary that was, like, that somebody could be so furious that they would take something so heavy, that they would do something so impossible with it. You know, it was just my first sort of, like, experience of this violence that comes from anger, and I experienced it on many levels. And I think that night really changed my relationship to the world, and it kind of set in place. And I've learned through more discovery about the nature of the way that we develop as kids. And 9 years old is a really important time. It's the time when, as children, we start to really take on a role in the family and a sense of responsibility and a sense of our own job. And I was given a job. So my mom left my dad to kind of force a change, tell him if he'd get clean, you know, that cycle. Well, maybe you don't know, I'm telling you my experience. To force the change, she said, I'm leaving you, it's it, we're divorcing. She immediately shacked up with another guy. I had this sense of, like, you weren't safe unless you had a partner. And I took on the responsibility of taking care of my brother and sister. She paid me to babysit when she had to go get a job working nights. So I would babysit my brother and sister and make food. I remember, like, the few types of food I knew how to make were so limited. And yeah, that it was hard for me with my little brother. He was always loud, and I remember hitting him. I remember, like, struggling and feeling guilty. I remember believing that was my job, and wanting to help out. I remember a point when I fought back, where later on in that year, after they'd been separated a while, and they were both kind of using me in this way of being their support person, the person they bitch about each other with, the person who's sitting in the front seat of the car, who's 9 years old, and they're, like, telling their adult problems to. And I was reflecting what I thought they should do, you know, just like that type of abuse of adultifying a child that happened early and often. So I just came away with this sense of, like, I have a high tolerance for pain, a high tolerance for dysfunction and chaos, and a high sense of responsibility for correcting that situation, you know, for believing that it was my job to bring it all together. And sort of like an unreasonable amount of strength to an ability to hold those things, like to hold that discomfort before I say no. And those are some of the things that I took on, that I onboarded from my family, that feel unhealthy as an adult, you know, in the world. My parents ended up getting back together after that year. So I was just reflecting to a fellow traveler that night that some issues I have with work right now, I think, trace back to that year where I really started to disconnect from school and, you know, completing assignments and caring in a way. And that really played out that year. My family overall, like as a bigger family, was very, at least on my dad's side, which is the sad side I identified with more, very achievement focused. I grew up, I don't know if you could catch it in this like thing I went through, but in my second great-grandparent generation, every single group is from a different country. And my dad's side growing up was all primarily Chinese. So, like, my grandpa's side was English, but then the big family that I experienced year after year was all Chinese. So I had this interesting experience as a very young child of being the only, like, little blonde girl at family events and kind of having an understanding of a multiracial identity as a little kid because I didn't quite fit. But those are my family. And I remember deciding when I was really little that I wanted to marry a Chinese man because I wanted my kid to fit in better than I did. I remember being jealous of my sister who looked more Chinese, and that's why I told her she was adopted and probably, like, messed with her a lot and, like, excluded her, right, as a defense. Yeah, my family growing up was really supportive, and that family, that Chinese family, my dad's side of the family, was very performance-oriented, achievement-oriented, career-oriented. They were all, you know, religious leaders and doctors and different types of very high-achieving people. And there was this legacy of high achievement. My great-great-grandfather had led the Chinese Olympic team and had led a university and had been the first, you know, Episcopal minister. Like, there were all these things, all these, like, big things always lauded about the whole family. And I remember that was a big part of the pressure that my dad felt, I think, to achieve, and the reason why to this day he still feels like he's somehow, like, underperformed. And I inherited that, you know, that sense of needing to prove myself, to be worthy of love by doing well. So fast forward a little, the way that I reacted, I think, to feeling unsafe in the world was to become more in control of it. Like, I sort of naturally have that tendency to jump in front and to volunteer to lead. But in childhood and on, you know, definitely starting in high school, if not before, I became a leader. I became an elected leader, like the president of things. And in college, when it feels like it's your opportunity to go and do something for you. It's where I felt safe. So I went into leadership there too, you know, like, yeah, I'll be the president of this building. I ran on this really awkward, like, campaign. Let's have fun. And I drew pictures that were the easiest to copy from these stickers that I had, and they were clowns. So my freshman year, I like campaigned to become president of the dorm by drawing clowns on posters, like having grown up in the woods, having no idea how creepy and scary that is. I was elected, which is funny. but that's kind of where I found my safe spot, was like, I'll just volunteer to be president. And if I'm in charge and I'm running the agenda, it just felt more comfortable for me. So I went to school and I started to kind of fight the sense of like self-worth stuff, voluntary. I kept being in charge of things. I kept having trauma because I kept putting myself, I'm sweating. It feels really hot right now. I kept putting myself in these positions to be, you know, like to be just like so in charge, like there, because I also came from not a lot of money. So it was like, well, I need to become an RA as soon as possible so I can afford to pay my own rent. And, you know, I know how to do this anyway, blah, blah, blah. So I became an RA, a resident assistant in charge of 50 people in a dorm hall, as a sophomore year in college, as a sophomore in college. And so much happens, in those spaces, you know, like crazy stuff. Hate crimes and traumas and like rapes and all this kind of stuff. I kind of lost myself a little bit. And in this pattern that's happened to me over time, I found that I can steer myself, like before asking for help, because I was conditioned to bear so much pain, it takes me so long to ask for help, you know, to like get to a point where I say that I need something, anything beyond what's my ability to affect. And that was one of the first times my sophomore year in college when I ended up on the floor of someone's office, like an advisor in a ball, right? Like where the trauma had gotten to a point and I didn't know how to deal with it. And I just was like curled up in a fetal position crying. And that's happened to me a few times in my life. And I think, is reflective of the nature of my ACA issues and the way that's what it takes. Like that my self-worth is sort of in this place and maybe less now. Yes. But was in this place where like, in order to believe I was deserving of support, I had to be in crisis. Yeah. So college, yeah, I wanted to grow and expand my mind. I got really into studying people. I was a student leader. I was doing volunteering and paid, like, advising stuff. I onboarded a sociology, Black studies. Like, I got really into studying people. And I had these dreams, certain dreams about, like, what I would do with my life, adventure. I had this idea that I would go to Ghana in college and I started like making those plans, but then I had this parallel sort of choice to make because I also applied to be an honors program advisor. And that kind of choice popped up again and again in my life where I ended up choosing the thing that was achievement based, that felt like it would look good on my record, that wasn't necessarily like the thing living in my heart that felt like my burning desire. And so that was the first version of that where I stayed. And I think I've replayed that choice over and over again in my life. So my senior year, I ended up not going to Ghana. I stayed in college. I wanted to take this job that felt like, you know, it was almost like the safer choice. It looked good on my resume. It matched with what I believed you needed to succeed in life, but it wasn't like my passion. So I went that route and that's how I ended up meeting the person who became my husband. So I worked at UCSB and I was 21 and I ended up meeting this guy and we, through mutual friends, we came to know one another, got close over email. We ended up together and he became my husband. And that's a long story that I think I probably won't go deep into, but he's such a big part of this, of the ACA story for me. So the very shorthand version is that, you know, this person for me was like my third relationship. So I became from maybe 6 years old. I don't know. Cause if you look at my journals, they're all about boys. I was so focused on finding love. And he was my third relationship. So at that point I'd had a very serious high school relationship where we were together for 4 years and I wore a promise ring and we were going to get married. And I'd had a very serious college relationship where we were going to get married. It was like, I was a serial monogamist. Everyone I got deep enough with to be with them, I was with them. Like, we were going to do this life together, you know? And then for whatever reason, at a point, it didn't work out. And it usually, in those kinds of relationships, definitely my college one, it was me feeling dissatisfied and not being able to communicate honestly about what I needed and then being mean instead of saying those things. And having that person decide that, like, they didn't like how that felt and deciding to leave. So in this new relationship, it was exciting and fun. And we ended up progressing and staying together for a really long time. And yet the nature of the relationship was always that I was more ready than he was. Like, I always knew the next thing I wanted and I was always pushing for that. And he was usually not there yet. but really liked me. And so it was always like confusing. And that went on for years with like varying degrees of what is the next thing, you know, what is the next thing that I want that he's not quite comfortable with. and that relationship included periods where we both struggled with things. Like, I definitely got into, as work got really busy after we stayed together for a while, I got really into smoking weed to do work after work should be done. You know, like, I'm going to need all these hours to do it. And what had been something fun for me became something that was like a tool that I was using to accomplish too much work. And then it became a tool that I was using to soothe myself from feeling like lonely and sad because our relationship started to shift. And, I really felt his pursuit of like other relationships outside of ours. And I started to feel really upset about our lack of closeness. And he started you know, we each had like these unfair requirements of one another and we've both grown a lot since then, but while our relationship progressed, I think we also struggled in ways that now I have programmed that I don't know if that would have been the same story. But we ended up getting married right before we got married, like 3 weeks before. We went into a therapist and talked to someone because we were like, well, like, we've been together 8.5 years and we've had some struggles along that way. And also like our physical intimacy doesn't work that well, but we still want to get married. Like, what do you think? This is 3 weeks before our wedding. So there's some part of us that like wasn't willing to let that go. And that like ultimately we got married, but I think that's a telling sign that like we went to therapy right before and weren't sure if that was the right choice. And we've had this agreement that, you know, that we loved each other a lot, that we would be friends, and that if it didn't work out, we'd figure it out, that we wouldn't hate each other, right? And it's maybe the promise that everyone makes, hoping never to have to figure that out. So we were married in 2009, and we both got really into roller derby. We lived together at various points. We bought and lost a house together. We had really big life experiences together, tons of travel, tons of trips. I love adventure. And we just, like, our worlds were expanding together and apart. And also, we were planning to have this family, but also we were still struggling with some of the things in our relationship that didn't work. And we ended up, you know, going deep into the world of roller derby, especially him. And also I got pregnant at the end of 2012 and it was sort of the last moment that we had any kind of physical intimacy. It was 4 years before we ended up separating. So a lot of that period of time in my marriage was really, really hard. The first 2 years after I got pregnant and had my kid and all of that, I was really beating myself up, like, believing that that was all about me, you know, that, like, I was this or I was that, or he didn't like me for whatever reason. And I kept it secret, you know, I didn't talk to people about it. Yeah. So I started talking to people about it, and it was right about then when I started voicing that I felt unhappy, that I learned from my brother that he had had a lot of great experiences with a group therapy, he called it. And ACA was something that I'd heard about when I was an RA. I'd gone to a training thing. And so it had been, you know, 19 years really. And I remember reading the laundry list, because that would have been 98 or 99. And I remember reading it and just crying, like bawling, identifying with it completely, but also like not believing that it was for me, because I was there as an RA, like getting resources for other people. And also, like, I was in college, I was fine, my dad was clean now, like, you know, that denial layer that told me that I didn't qualify. And so now 19 years later, my brother was like, oh yeah, I've been going to this thing, it's called ACA. And I was like, oh, I've heard of that. I bought the book, I started reading it. At that point, in 2016, so I started in June 2016. That was a really hard year for us, for me. It was the year that he and I were doing like a trial separation. We were pretty serious at this point that it didn't work and it wasn't good for us, but we had this kid together and we're trying to figure out whether or not we could be apart, and have that still be good for her. And I started reading this book, and she was two, and I felt the critical need to do life differently than I experienced it. And so I felt this compelling need to do this program for her and for me. But I think the fact that she was on the earth helped me stay focused, you know. But I was also finding so much healing in it, just reading the book. So I read that book, that first three chapters, while we were still going to therapy. I remember him saying at one point that I had changed entirely. And I think that's true, because it gave me some tools, like the immediate tools, the serenity prayer that says that I'm only responsible for myself. That was like earth shattering for me to hear that. It was like a big deal. And to go to a meeting with people where I heard other stories that felt similar to my own, and to hear that people had learned and grown, that was really important to me. Yeah, my little brother's 6 years younger than me. So when he came into the world, I remember my mom crying. She was 28 and she didn't want another kid. but I'm so glad I have the siblings I do, and that it worked out that way, because I learn and grow from them. My grandma Eva, my dad's mom, she was the, like, this example in my life of unconditional love. And I feel like I have these totems in my life that help me steer sometimes, you know, because I feel blessed and gifted that I have these unconditional love examples. Anyway, so ACA, I found, my daughter was two in 2016, and I started going to the Monday meeting, and that's pretty much all I could fit in my life. was Monday meetings, but it was really powerful and really important. And I, for a while, was working that program with a sponsor. And I think then, and even still, kind of resistant to doing the work, like the inventory and the stuff. It's just my stuff. Like the act of doing work is hard for me. Work in general. And so, I've been involved in meetings, I do phone calls, I do step work, but my step work kind of got stalled out. So I'm re-engaging. Like, I've tried at various points to re-engage with my step work. I'm on step four still. That feels like a confession. But I also feel like apart from that, I've had this, you know, the work that I've done so far on that step, and then so much that I've learned from, I don't know, being with fellow travelers, going to meetings, having phone calls, you know, having long extended conversations after meetings, putting on workshops and fun things, and, you know, like honoring myself. So as much as I feel kind of dissatisfied with where I'm at in like the true program work, because now, well, I'm excited also because now I feel like I've had enough exposure to what comes next, you know, to like the freedom of step five and like the inspiration of step six and seven. And like, I don't know, I'm all excited now. Like I want to get to those places. I want, you know, what people have who have gone through those steps. So I feel this renewed sense of motivation. And I also know that the program for me has been essential in a number of ways that the tools, different tools that I've taken from it, during this time. So Evan and I ended up splitting up in officially 2017 in February, like the first week of February. The very next week, I lost my job. Like they laid me off. And so the universe just kind of like cleared everything for me. And that seems like that's sometimes how it happens. Like everything just is gone. And that for me was definitely a bottom. And it was a chance for me to like meet new people and fill up my cup in a way, you know, like have the blessing of other people who were part of my life to help me with that. And also onboard some tools to do that for myself. I wrote down here, the things we pay attention to are the things that grow. And I do feel that finite sense of time and how we spend our time being really important. I got super into ACA meetings really as a result of COVID even. So that I was doing a lot more online meetings. And then really recently I had a friend die. So in 2017, when Evan and I separated and I lost my job and there's this epic rainstorm that night. And that night I ended up connecting with somebody who had also lost his job, who I'd worked with for a few years. And we hung out really intensely for a number of months and became close. And also, you know, that relationship kind of saw its course for a moment. And I had this idea that like, maybe he would kind of grow up and become somebody I wanted to be with. But we kept talking to each other, and recently he died, and I experienced that sense of knowing someone who maybe was undiagnosed ACA, you know, like, and was chasing that excitement. And I felt with such deep sense, the sense of responsibility for his life and sadness. And it really took me to a deep, hard place in the last few weeks. And I had to, one of the things I learned that was so interesting for me was this idea of honoring my voice, like honoring myself through the things that are hard. That, like in this case, I had an experience with him at the end of last year where I felt like I saw him and I couldn't speak, like I couldn't say, I couldn't offer support. And I was attributing to myself a lot of responsibility for his sadness because of that moment. And I really appreciated it. And I have with me this sense of like gratitude for a fellow traveler who said that I have to express that part of me that wasn't able to help or that said no, you know, that's an important feeling too. And that I realize that sometimes I can abandon myself because I'll have this judgment that's based on this belief, having grown up as I did, believing I was responsible. I'll have this judgment of myself when something happens, and that in the time looking back, like there was some part of me that said that wasn't able to act, and that it's possible to let that part speak to like when we think about loving ourselves and accepting ourselves, that is something we have to do every single day. That has come to be real for me in like waves and layers. Because I find it's easy for me to abandon myself. It's easy for me if someone says, or it can be, if someone says, you're doing this wrong, I'll get kind of focused on that, on their words, you know? And so this program and the people in the program have helped me to stand with myself and to feel a sense of okayness in the world, because it's enabled me to understand the feeling of separation with love. You know, that separation with love is this sense of like, your feelings don't have to be my feelings, that, and that I don't have to take care of you, that even though I might feel like I know you better, I don't have to take care of you. I kind of skipped the part where I talked about my job. It became that my career over time, for the last 15 years at least, has been to be a corporate event manager. So, you know, in a lot of ways, like, I really formalized that role in my life of taking care of everyone and making sure that I controlled everyone's experiences and how they felt about the world. And I've done a really great job in a lot of ways in that role. You know, people love me in that role. Like, I don't stress out when everything's all stressful. And I'm also in this really interesting process of trying to understand what is it? Who am I, right? What is this passion that I have for life? Because I do believe that there's a light inside of us that's meant to shine in a really specific and unique way, and that it is our role in the world to find that and shine on, you know, to be ourselves. But when you believe these things about yourself that are so deeply ingrained, it's really hard to unpack that. And it takes a conversation. It takes reflection with fellow travelers sometimes to hear what it is you're saying. You know, maybe even you might hear the words, but you might not know the content. So I've really, really, really appreciated more than anything those long conversations that I have with other people who have a similar perspective, who have an ACA perspective, who are able to see and speak from that place that sort of comes with all the beautiful packaging that we have around how you honor someone's share and how you reflect versus advise. I've really loved that. So now I'm kind of transitioning in my thing to like tools. I'm thinking about ACA and I'm thinking of sharing with you like tools that I've loved. I shared the family tree and meetings and phone calls and conversations. I also love the ACA Bill of Rights. I printed it out because, I don't know, we had it at some point. It's on our website, and I starred the ones that are really important to me because it's easy. Like, absolutely, I was dismissed a lot of times from believing that I had a right, you know? Like, I'm in the cab of the truck, and my dad's lighting a cigarette, and we're on a road trip, and it's a tiny truck, and I, like, opened the window a little, and he's like, got mad at me. And so I went like this. And then he got really pissed at me when I covered my mouth. And like basically dismissed my reality, right? Like, it doesn't smell like smoke in here. And you know, things like that all the time where you come to disbelieve your right to have, to say no. So the Bill of Rights is really good for me. And still, I'm so reliant on other people, though. I still love my fellow travelers, and like having them reiterate things is really, really great. Service. I've been doing service the whole time. I find it, service and my relationship is interesting because sometimes service is like a role that puts me right back into my traits. And it's something where it's easy for me to go back to this, like, the things I know already versus exploring them and doing service as a new kind of person in ACA, roles like secretary of a meeting, you know, I had rules in my mind about how that's supposed to look. And so coming in with like an openness to doing service in a new way has been really, really interesting. And I've learned the most even in reflection, like in conflict almost, or in sharing something that feels uncomfortable or hard. And in having people in ACA respond differently than what I've had in my history, you know, and having those people just be different has been really enlightening for me because, yeah, I learn, and it's often different than the workplace too. Affirmations I put next to my bed, so I picked the ones I wanted from whichever chapter that is, and kind of rewrote them, and that's a new thing for me in the last couple months. The step 3 prayer is also written next to my bed to remind me to ask for help. to remind me to be willing. I've really enjoyed the things in the book that helped me, recenter myself and surrender. That I find that the concept of surrender and willingness and a trust in a higher power is something I need to remind myself of every day, because it's so easy to get caught back up in believing that I'm in charge. And I don't know, Mary, what do you think about timing? Should I keep talking or should I pause for questions?
Well, we could have some questions, but I'm just wondering if there's anything like a final kind of words of wisdom or whatever you'd like to say, and then we could open it up for about 5 minutes of questions.
Yeah, I actually was thinking that my last thought, I recently went through a really important motion in my coming to me, my growth story, right? There's still a lot going on. So I said in 2017, my ex and I split up, but we're still going through that process of divorce. A lot of it has been delayed because maybe both of us are, but definitely from my side, I'm really resistant to, like, it's scary. Like, as much as we've been apart and living apart, there's something so final about it that where I feel untethered, it's almost like I steered myself, toward partnership for so long, believing that would be my safe space. So cutting it loose is scary. And even though it's mostly done, that part is mostly done, it's still the finality of that standing on my own in the world. This feels like it'll be my first time, So it's really scary. And I kind of invented this ceremony that, like, coming up with these things and asking for these things has been a result of ACA, but created this ceremony because I hated the divorce process. Like, I don't know how anybody gets married twice, honestly. It's like, I don't know how you get married again after going through a divorce once. But I created this thing. It was like a spiritual thing, and we did this sort of spiritual uncoupling, and that just happened a week and a half ago. And it's just these steps, right? Like these little steps that help me. And it is important for me to remember progress, not perfection. Then there's no such thing as failure. That it's beyond my control, and that whatever doesn't work out, it wasn't meant to work out. That because of ACA, I can remove my emotional attachment to outcomes. That because there's a higher power, I don't have to be emotionally tied to the things I expect to happen. That having expectations in the first place is creating my sense of loss, and that having trust instead allows me to receive what comes. I felt really moved today when I watched, not ACA related, but a masterclass by RuPaul, who was like, so like our program language is so in what he talked about when you talk about becoming yourself and speaking with an authentic voice, representing yourself in the world authentically, but like being your brightest self. He's talking about, that a constant pattern you'll recognize in life is the sense of dying to your old self and being reborn into a higher version of yourself. And I do feel like that is some of the active work that we're doing here, is this active evolution. It's this active, conscious growth. And I see the way in which my generational dysfunction is changing at me, and it's changing after me, because I'm putting my attention into growing that part of my life. I want to just keep watering it and having that growth sustained from a really, from a healthy foundation, from what I've done, the work I've done so far, to kind of tear it back and rebuild it. So thank you all for being part of that with me.
Thanks, Amber.
Yay, Amber.
Thank you. Thank you for listening.
Where's Burke?